Welcome! My name is Alexandre Joyce, and this is my master's thesis. I was studying at the University of Montreal in the Design and Complexity master's program. Without further ado, here we go. In 2006, when the German philosopher Habermas accepted a prize for the advancement of human rights, he commented on the way the internet is changing the way we gather knowledge. The internet has provided a space for an avalanche of user-generated content. This sudden rise in user participation has created problems for both our professional media sources and our most valued cultural institutions, by weakening the value of online content and by increasing the cacophony. And we quote, "Use of the internet has both broadened and fragmented the context of communication. This is why the internet can have a subversive effect on intellectual life in an authoritarian regime. But at the same time, the less formal, horizontal cross-linking of communication channels weakens the achievements of traditional media. This focuses the attention of an anonymous and dispersed public on selected topics and information, allowing citizens to concentrate on the same critically filtered issues and journalistic pieces at any given time. The price we pay for the growth in egalitarianism offered by the internet is the decentralized access to unedited stories. In this medium, contributions by intellectuals lose their power to create a focus." This is Jürgen Habermas. So, the internet has created a debate on its use in the field of communications. Media companies have had to rival with user-generated content, providing similar services to keep their core audience. One of the main critiques is that, when unconstrained by professional standards or editorial filters, anonymous amateurs aren't held responsible for the quality of the information that they are distributing to such a large audience. By editing an entry on Wikipedia, publishing a blog, or posting a video on YouTube, the distinction between trained expert and passionate amateur is increasingly blurred. If everyone is simultaneously broadcasting themselves, who is listening? But today's internet audience isn't listening at all. It's participating. Secondly, it is the creative institutions that have been affected by today's kleptomania, cut-and-paste, and self-broadcasting culture. The very foundation of intellectual property is being questioned when content is freely exchanged, downloaded, mashed up, published, aggregated, and consumed. Moreover, the manner and frequency with which intellectual property is being undermined over the internet is distorting and reshaping our values and our very culture. The internet has become a unique place where audience and author have become one. Consequently, culture has been either converging towards a unique source or diverging into multiple niches. Is the internet democratizing access or creating unfertile grounds for future culture? Simply put, an amateur is a person who is fond of something. An amateur is a hobbyist, knowledgeable or otherwise, someone who does not make a living from his or her field of interest. With the help of the internet, groups of amateurs are forming the digital equivalent of online gated communities where they share identical views and the whole conversation is mirrored in a way that is reassuringly familiar. Paradoxically, to the idea of aggregated communities of the like-minded amateurs, one person's truth becomes as true as anyone else's. And we quote, "In this era of exploding media technologies, there is no truth except the truth that you create for yourself." That was from Eldeman in Liquid Truth Advice from the Spin Masters. Today's media is dividing the world into a billion personalized truths, each seemingly equally valid and meaningful. One way to look at this phenomenon of user-generated content can be as a data miner's dream. The more we reveal ourselves through our MySpace pages, our YouTube videos, our blogs, the more vulnerable we become to snoops, blackmailers, voyeurs, and gossips. The confessional nature of user-generated culture is resulting in a cultural explosion of personal, social, and political self-revelation. In parallel, more and more technical barriers and even copyright laws are being built in to prevent this information from being used negatively. However, a different perspective can be taken on this debate. The angle that we choose to adopt focuses on the positive aspects of the internet that Habermas was discussing. He alludes to the power of democratization of the internet with its subversive effects, decentralized access, and egalitarianism. What we're proposing is that all this information from user-generated content can be used positively in the design process. More than ever, people want to participate proactively in the design process. In many domains, Users have already become active in modifying or creating solutions for themselves to satisfy their needs and desires. Contrarily to what the author on Internet Trends, Andrew Keen, has been fearing, the Internet can be a fertile ground, enabling large numbers of users to become active in generating content. This research was conducted to better understand the relationship between the simplicity of user participation over the Internet and the pertinence of the content created for the design process. To do so, we will study the user-generated content over the Internet in a form of crowdsourcing for the initial phases of the design process. What is crowdsourcing? Crowdsourcing is a phenomenon that started in 2006, where large amounts of people were accomplishing tasks over the Internet. Crowdsourcing is a part of the broader Web 2.0 phenomenon that has been giving users the opportunity to participate and play a role on the web. Different from the initial website with fixed and pre-established content, the Web 2.0 model is heterogeneous, ad hoc, and evolutionary. But above all, it is pragmatic and robust, allowing tools and applications to evolve naturally alongside each other, shaped by the communities that they serve. One novelty of Web 2.0 is that it allows for gathering a collective intelligence, turning the web into a global brain. In other words, Blogger, YouTube, Wikipedia, and other Web 2.0 websites are putting into practice the idea of user-generated content by building a centralized collection of knowledge on the web. To uncover the relationships that allow for crowdsourcing to take place, we have established three essential poles. Increasingly, participating amateurs have taken over the Internet thanks to Web 2.0 websites. But crowdsourcing only takes place when a third element is introduced into the relationship, when this participation is oriented towards a project. As users participate in projects, the development is creating content. On the other side of the equation, when the Internet is used to support projects, it serves as an aggregator of knowledge. Therefore, another way to see crowdsourcing is the aggregation of created content amid Web 2.0 activities. Can crowdsourcing integrate the design process? In the earlier stages of the design profession, designers have relied heavily on the expertise of others by referring to textbooks, standards, legal constraints, and especially previous design efforts. Today, there is so much knowledge to be contextualized that there needs to be more people included into the design process. We live in a time of distributed cognition. Aggregating points of view becomes a necessity as specialization increases. This research looks to study this problem by proposing a method for taking advantage of user-generated content in the initial phases of design. How did we structure this research thesis? In the first chapter, we will continue on researching how the Internet has been breeding change through the lens of the field of complexity. We will reveal how this research has been strongly influenced by the foundations of complexity in design research. With this approach, we will revisit the phenomenon leading our initial research question on user-generated content in design. To answer this research question, the second chapter will build the theoretical foundations in design with which we will conduct this study. Precisely, we will describe the design process and the problem, creative, and solution spaces, as well as describing research for design with the relationships between user, object, and context. Also, we will distinguish products, systems, and services as three different design outputs. The objective of the third chapter is to present our methodology. We will begin by addressing this complex design problem of using the multiple points of views provided by user-generated content in the light of participatory design methods. Afterwards, we will study the beginning of participatory design, how its methodologies have been developed in other fields. Inspired by participatory design methods, we will propose a methodology for the purposes of answering the two founding questions that shape this research. In the fourth chapter, we will answer the research questions by comparing and contrasting the results obtained in our field research. The foundations that we have established in Chapter 2 will become the base of our interpretation of the role of each variable in the results. Finally, we will propose ways to use this information in researching for design. The final chapter proposes to reflect upon the consequences of the study in terms of the opportunities provided by the Internet as described in the first chapter. By looking back on our research on user-generated content, we will provide insight on how the Internet is affecting the design process. Moreover, we will discuss how this broader perspective on user participation can influence the role of the designer. Lastly, we will provide insight into how the relationships between users and designers is changing the way we perceive the very activity of design. Now that the table is set for this thesis, we will begin by developing this master's in design research by studying the complexity of the Internet. Chapter 1, The Complexity of the Internet. In this chapter, we will review how complexity was an integral part in developing this master's project. Beginning in the early 1960s, complexity is a relatively new field that branches out into two different forms. Under the name of constructivism, complexity proposes an epistemology for generating knowledge during the development of a project. Secondly, complexity proposes itself as a field of study on its own, as a science that studies systems. Both perspectives were useful in this case of research project, and we will discuss how they were put into application. Firstly, we conducted this research on user participation in researching for design, inspired by the complex approach of thinking and acting at the same time. In a form of meta-methodology, complexity was helpful in defining this researcher's point of view and creating a model to identify the relationships at play in this research. We speak of meta-methodology because we need to distinguish between the constructivist methodology of this research project as a whole, defining the problem, reviewing the literature, and developing a project, and the mechanist methodology that will be discussed in Chapter 3 to precisely answer this research question. Secondly, in the earlier stages of the profession, designers have relied heavily on the expertise of others in an effort to understand and contextualize existing knowledge. And, because of the abundance of knowledge, there needs to be more people included into the design process. That's why divisions of labor and collaborative strategies have been created to accomplish tasks more extensive and complex than any individual could accomplish. Both of these benefits, or ideals, of the complex approach will be put into action in this research. This research is conducted in an effort to take into account the already available content of online users and demonstrate the democratization of the creative design activity to more than expert designers. What are the four dimensions of the constructivist project? Another great thinker behind the complex approach is Jean-Louis Lemoine. In contrast to Descartes' reductionism, he has described the constructivist epistemology as studying a phenomenon as a projected construction of the observer. In other words, the subject constructs the objects of study within a project. The relationship between the subject and the object is now to be discussed as the once objective and detached observer is now implicated in the project and influencing the object of study. The constructivist approach has led to better understanding systems. Moreover, systems have been defined as something identifiable, which is in something, for something, doing something, by something, which transforms in time. From this, the four dimensions of systems have been identified: the subject, the object, the project, and the environment. To illustrate the theoretical structure of this research, we have taken the time to explore the relationships that are present amongst the dimensions at play. We have chosen to portray the three bottom dimensions of the tetrahedron. Therefore, the subject of this research will be the participative users and designers, the environment will be that of the Internet, and the object of study is design research for products and services. How did the field of complex systems begin? The leading thinker behind the study of complexity is Edgar Morin. He dates the notion of complexity to the early 1950s, where the first connections were made between cybernetics, systems theory, and information theory. Consequently, the notion of complexity emerged. Cybernetics is the theory of autonomous machines. In opposition to the principle of linear cause and effects, cybernetics studied retroactions and regulation. These concepts were characterized by the presence of a feedback loop that amplifies or diminishes the initial cause, creating an autonomous system. Systems theory has become the basis for organizational thinking. In the organization of a whole, the different parts can have retroactions. The study of these types of systems has led to the principle of emergence, which states that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Although Marin has deciphered 7 more principles of systemic organization that contradict and counterbalance each other, emergence impacts most significantly this research study. Information theory studies systems where order and chaos cohabit simultaneously. From the order in repetition and the chaos in randomness is constructed a governed whole that organizes the information. As time goes by, this becomes a form of auto-organization that regulates the extremes. Even with its foundation in the 3 previously described fields of study, complexity is still hard to define precisely and concisely. Complexity is certainly not to be interpreted as something that is simply complicated, but rather as that which is constructed of many related parts. In 1962, Simon sidestepped the daunting task of defining complexity by stating that the property of a complex system refers to the large number of parts that interact in a non-simple way. Having studied the evolution of science and systems theory, Checklin states that complexity is present when there are more variables than one scientist can manage. He also professes that to study such systems, complexity must differentiate itself of the mechanist way of reductionism by attempting to create relationships amongst entities. Likewise, in this research, the importance of complex systems will come from its emphasis on the relationships between the elements more than on the elements themselves. What are the founding principles in complex systems? The founding principles of complex systems are the dialogical principle, the organizational recursion principle, and the hologrammatical principle. The dialogical principle concerns the antagonistic and simultaneously complementary relationships within a system. The paradoxical interrelationship of phenomena creates a balance within the extremes of the system. For example, at the same time, a system to manage order and disorder. In fact, the notion of order does not exist without the notion of disorder. Secondly, the organizational recursion principle allows for the system to regenerate itself, maintain itself, while at the same time influenced by its surrounding environment. This principle is also known as auto-eco-reorganization, where auto refers to self-regulation, eco refers to its relationship with the environment, and re refers to its recursive regeneration. For example, the organization of life on Earth itself is regulated and highly dependent on the relationships within its environment. The Earth has been regenerating itself with itself ever since its first appearance. Lastly, the hologrammatical principle states that the whole is expressed within each part, and inversely, the parts express the whole. Therefore, each dimension contains within it all other dimensions. This principle is widely used in the field of mathematics under the name of fractal theory. Similarly, DNA contains all the genetic information that is manifested in a human being, and likewise, a human being expresses all the genetic information contained in DNA. How does the Internet follow these 3 complex principles? The Internet can be deemed as a complex system because it follows the 3 previously described principles. The Internet manages antagonistic and complementary relationships in multiple ways. There are websites that are built for user participation where anyone can submit a video, and there are websites that showcase proprietary content. Some email providers are free, but they include advertising, and some email services are to be purchased, yet without advertising. It is these very paradoxes that allow for the system to cater to all types of uses and users. TheWayBackMachine.org is an internet website that can go back in time and show what a web page looked like in 1996. Google also keeps cached copies of websites to better understand how sites evolve. So thanks to the nodal form of its networks, the internet's ability to reorganize itself allows it to remain a functional system as a whole in spite of large-scale malfunctions. These 2 examples show that the internet as a whole shows signs of auto-eco-reorganization. It can auto-regulate itself thanks to HTML language, which evolves according to the advances in technology, meanwhile addressing the needs that are present in the real world. Lastly, it is not difficult to understand that the sum of all the websites make up the internet as a whole. Although unlikely at first, the reverse is equally possible. The whole internet is available in one browser. You can have access to the whole internet thanks to the browser that reads the HTML language like a cell would read its DNA. Now that we have shown how the internet manifests all the characteristics of a complex system, we will look further into how the internet is fostering innovation. How is the internet a system for innovation? In this section, we will illustrate how the internet is designed to support innovation and enable new ideas. No modern phenomenon better demonstrates the importance of open structures to innovation and creativity than the internet. The internet has provided for the world's greatest demonstration of the power of freedom because of two distinct characteristics: its structure and its openness. The structure of the internet can be described both vertically and horizontally. From a vertical point of view, the layers of the internet refer to the entire communication system. At the bottom is the physical layer, comprised of wires and servers across which information travels. Secondly, there is a logical or code layer where software controls the hardware. At the top is the content layer, where images, text, and information in general are created and displayed. On the other hand, the horizontal structure of the internet is more complicated. The internet is based on a network of architecture that favors innovation for three reasons. Firstly, applications run on computers that are at the edge of the network. Innovators with new application need only to connect their computer to the network to let their applications run. This does not imply a change for every computer within the network. For example, if someone wanted to create a new online telephone application, they can do so without imposing a change to the whole network. Secondly, the architecture of the internet is not optimized for any particular existing application. The internet has no dominant purpose to which its resources are being focused. Therefore, the network remains open to innovation not originally imagined. In cases where the future is uncertain, like with the uses of future technology, leaving the platform uncontrolled is a better way of helping it find the right sort of innovation. Thirdly, the internet's architecture remains a neutral platform. Neither discrimination nor preference is enforced upon any information source. This neutral platform allows for innovators to develop any idea or application, whether it good or bad. Again, it is because innovators don't require the permission of any governing body for authorization of any software program that they can propose solutions using the internet and in original ways. The second factor that drives innovation over the internet is its openness. The openness of the internet refers to a common, which is a resource that is free. The internet is held in joint use or possession, and can be enjoyed equally by a number of people. Commons also don't require obtaining the permission to use the resource. A distinction is to be made between rivalrous and non-rivalrous resources. For example, the beach is a rivalrous common because if everyone tries to use it, their usage rivals someone else's. However, the use of a quote is non-rivalrous. It is important to value the internet as an innovation common. Through its norms and a specific technical architecture, the internet creates a space where one person's use does not impede another's. Because of the openness of the internet, creativity of online users is expanding and reaching extraordinary ranges of cultures and commerce. That is to go from a life of a consumer to a life of a prosumer, where one can individually and collectively participate in answering needs. Digital technology could enable a whole generation to take part in the creative process and thereby generate content in a myriad of mediums. Remixed films, new forms of music, digital art, new kinds of storytelling, written expression, poetry, criticism, political activism. The infrastructure that is the internet now allows for aggregating that creativity with others. This could become a research strategy for designers. Put together, this open structure of the internet led the way to creating an innovative atmosphere in its content layer. The internet's architecture made it possible for developers to create applications that themselves allowed for users to demonstrate their innovations. For example, the developers behind the website YouTube took advantage of the internet's neutrality of content and decided to grant users the same neutrality in uploading their content. The Wikipedia website took advantage of the fact that a user on the edge of the network can create or modify a web page without having to affect all other pages on the site. And finally, blogs aren't optimized for publishing any dominant subject or style of information. That's why some people use blogs to post images of their cats and others to host political debates. The modular design of the internet facilitates its own evolution and the subsequent evolution of complementary businesses as well, as fostering new opportunities. Now that we have seen how, from a technical standpoint, the internet has been fostering innovation and creativity, there has also been a social movement towards participating over the internet. From this social perspective, the internet has also proven to be a fertile ground for enabling large numbers of users to become active in generating content. We will now move to study the foundation of participative users. Furthermore, we have decided to focus our attention specifically to the relationship between the simplicity of active participation over the internet and the user's will to innovate. So why are users participating online? In 2006, Time Magazine's Person of the Year was you! They were referring to people participating over the web. This establishes the presence of a critical mass of user participation online. One of the consequences of user-generated content is a change in the nature of some interactions between individuals over the internet. This exemplifies the shift from the cathedral-like practice of one person speaking to the masses to the network of individuals, all taking part in a bazaar. In business terms, the offer and the demand are becoming more specialized, creating a greater market in each of the niche products and services. Introducing change is difficult to manage. There is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. This comes from Machiavelli. This risk of initiating change is very present in new product development. To avoid costly product failures, companies are starting to integrate users into the design process and ask for their commitment to purchase early on. For one thing, customers are now empowered with greater access to information, so that many want to have a greater say about products they purchase. Not surprisingly, then, studies have shown that timely and reliable knowledge about customer preferences and requirements is the single most important area of information necessary for product development. Basically, people want to take part in the product development, and avant-garde companies are finding ways to let it happen. So far, this has happened in the various types of situations where users find themselves in small heterogeneous markets and where little user experience exists. At the present time, the studies of Von Hippel, Piller, and others have established that users have already been active in creating solutions for themselves to answer their needs and desires. Consequently, this research was conducted to better understand the equation of simplicity of participation over the internet with users' capacity to innovate based on personal experience. What are these users generating as content with their everyday experiences? This section is concerned with user participation in various online activities. To understand this new phenomenon, we approach the subject on three scales: on a macro level with the rise of participation, on a meso level with crowdsourcing, then on a micro level with the different types of actions that participation allows. Macro level, the rise of participation. After the rise of the liberal professions in the 20th century, we are now witnessing a shift. Simplifying technology and access to information has created the rise of educated amateurs. What is being called the Pro-Am Revolution is a phenomena that shows how enthusiastic amateurs pursuing activities to professional standards are having an increasingly important role in our society and economy. This movement has come from the bottom-up self-organization of large quantities of Pro-Ams, leading to a critical mass of people and knowledge in space and time. Pro-Ams are the ones who seem to know everything about their passion. Thanks to the internet, they have access to widely available information and the specific know-how required to invest themselves and their earnings to master their activity of choice. So much so that designers have begun to create niche products targeting Pro-Am users. The simplest example of the real impact of amateurs taking on the role of professionals can be seen in the photography industry. The level of training has been reduced considerably because technology has advanced significantly and has become so simple to use. So much so that stock photography sites are now paying amateurs for their quality images. The stock photography industry has been just one of the sources for new Pro-Ams trends over the internet. What is important to gather from these examples are the underlying trends. In this case, stock photography was the basis for discovering crowdsourcing, which happens when companies are trying to leverage the generated output of the Pro-Ams towards accomplishing a task. Today, designers are looking to engage with the Pro-Ams and are developing the activities that relate to their products. However, it has been a common practice for companies' marketing departments to have already established such relationships with their customers to get to know what they were thinking. But now, designers want to know what they're tinkering. Mezzo, the crowdsourcing principles. Enter crowdsourcing, a 2006 internet phenomenon. Crowdsourcing is the action of asking large amounts of people to accomplish tasks using the internet as a network. The neologism crowdsourcing was coined in the context of businesses outsourcing specialized tasks to amateurs over the net. Now the productive potential of millions of online amateurs is attracting the attention of businesses and professionals. In the end, solutions could come from the productive potentials of millions of plugged-in enthusiasts. By collecting the input of public online, crowdsourcing allows for a problem to be handled by virtual crowds, then rewarding those with the best ideas. These problems are divided into tasks that can vary from the more specific, like transcribing the spoken words of a podcast, to the more general, like taking a picture of a dog. Some tasks can even be poetic and abstract, like drawing happiness. In stride with the rise of professional amateurs, participants who are taking part in crowdsourcing don't consider it work, because to them leisure isn't passive consumerism, but active and participatory. By crowdsourcing the creativity of pro-ams, this is in fact including them into the design process. They get involved and are enthused by showing off their knowledge and skills publicly. Sometimes, they can reveal inside information that has involved sacrifices from frustrations never considered before. The question is now, how do designers interact with pro-ams? Crowdsourcing embodies a complex principle where the average response of a large group of people is nearly always better than any individual's answer. According to this concept of collective wisdom of crowds, large group of diverse individuals will come up with better and more robust forecasts and make more intelligent decisions than even the most skilled decision maker. This thought is an argument for aggregating the knowledge of many people. And that's the subject of the book of The Wisdom of Crowds by James Surowiecki. In some ways, the idea that more heads are better than one is the foundation of this theory and this master's on design research. There are many different ways of harnessing the knowledge of crowds proposed in the book. We will briefly review these ideas while applying them to design thinking. Through crowdsourcing, one of the opportunities is to begin studying how group wisdom could impact design research. Diversity. Diversity is part of human nature. We are all unique and different. In design, diversity tends to study as many points of view as possible, bringing the maximum amount of marginal or innovative ideas to the table. Independence is the base of democracy. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. There should also be a place for everyone to discuss and debate their point of view. In design, independence is steering clear of paradigms and listening to your own senses. Decentralization is about making sure people's local knowledge is valued. It concerns itself with the culture, which is very present in design. Cultures having different ways and traditions to get to the same tasks. There is a great source of new and exciting ideas to be explored and developed thanks to the decentralization criteria. Aggregation is what unites all different inputs into one single space. In design, it's where the sum of all the parts makes a whole. We have established that crowdsourcing is part of the Web 2.0 phenomenon that has been giving users the opportunity to participate on the web. We see crowdsourcing as the aggregation of created content during Web 2.0 activities. This leads us to the next section where we look at these participative activities and what they are. Micro, types of online participation activities. A study published in April 2007 revealed many statistics of current online participation. When looking at these early figures, we must take into account that online participation has only become truly mainstream after 2006. Nonetheless, the three graphs will show the levels of participation in social media, the percentage of submitters versus viewers, and finally, the different types of participation that online users can take part in. First of all, social media usage versus web traffic. The rise in online participation has been foreshadowed by the Pro-Am revolution. Simply put, the same mechanisms are at play, but in an online arena. There is the same will to create bottom-up self-organization of large quantities of Pro-Ams, leading to a critical mass of people and knowledge in space and time. Another example is the rise in participation that has come from Time magazine naming the people who participate online as the person of year. Although this graph is meant to show the progression of over 600% growth in 1 year, the second information that is provided is the percentage of online activity related to social media compared to the total web traffic. Therefore, 12% of all online activity is a beginning point for measuring participation. Second up is content creation per visit. Comparing the amounts of time people visit a site to the amount of times people have created content is not the most pertinent way to gather active participation levels. It seems only logical that people simply watch videos 99.84% of the time when they go on YouTube. The same goes for looking at pictures on Flickr. The case of Wikipedia differs because the original content, text, can be easily modified. A better understanding of the participation levels would come from comparing the amount of content creators to the amount of users. Of course, this is more difficult to keep track of, since some visitors aren't registered users. By comparing registered users that have uploaded a video to those who haven't, would probably paint a very different picture. There is another piece of information that overshadows this comparison between active content creation visits and passive content contemplation visits. The sheer amount of online content is so prevalent that the need for creation of new content hasn't been felt. This graph seems to show that very little amounts of users create content. This is not entirely true. Even if 0.16% of visits generate content, the sheer amount of visits is unfathomable. Let's not forget that YouTube holds more than 69 million videos. Lastly, there are participation activities. The different types of participations show a great variety in the activities that are taking place in Web 2.0. The most relevant type of participation to this research is by far the creators. Critics can also play a role in design research by pointing out the faults and describing their needs. Collectors would be the role of the design researcher that would amass the information and translate it into a meaningful content in a project. Joiners are the people who use networking sites but are the type of activity shows more of interest for studying markets. Spectators are completely passive, and the only piece of information they offer to design research is in the number of views. When large amounts of spectators watch a video, therein lies some interest. Of course, inactives are excluded as they don't provide any content to be studied in design research. Accompanying these types of participation, an annexed graph shows the basic demographics related to each type of participation. Basically, we can observe that after 27 years of age, the participation levels decrease. To answer the question of how many people participate actively versus passively, we now have some figures. Of all the people online, 40% on average are spectators, and 21% are creating content. So in general, nearly half the people on Web 2.0 sites are creating content. Although it is of great implication to think that one out of two people submit personal content online, we didn't focus on the quantitative aspects of participation, nor the demographics of participation. Those would be two other studies. We are more interested in understanding the potential of user-generated content for design research. To sum up, these three graphs have demonstrated important elements in online user participation. Firstly, we are in the initial burst of Web 2.0 participation, and levels of participation are rising exponentially. Secondly, so many people are visiting the sites that it makes it look as though not many people are submitting content. And lastly, active participation can be split up into five different types: creators, critics, collectors, joiners, and spectators. Now that companies want to take part in this new field of social media, we are looking to study this user participation. What will this research entitle? So far in this thesis, we have established the influence of complex design in providing an approach to this research and understanding of systems. Complexity has proven to structure this research by studying the relationships amongst the subject, object, project, and environment. In addition, the characteristics of complex systems have shown that the Internet is a dialogical, recursive, and hologrammatical system. This led us to further question the link between the Internet and complex design. The open structure of the Internet has revealed to be a conductor of innovative practices. The three communication layers create an elaborate network that is neutral, unspecific, and open-ended. Basically, the Internet is a system built to support innovation. For the most part, innovation has come from the users. The greatest revolution over the Internet has been the advent of online participation. With roots in the Pro-Am movement, large numbers of users have begun to take over the Internet for their own purposes. Crowdsourcing is a prominent example of how this participation has become a means to an end. Moreover, the rise of online participation has taken on the form of many different types of activity, like user-generated content. With respect to our current research and experimentations with online crowdsourcing efforts, the early stages of the design process has been the most potent phase of the design process for integrating user-generated content. We propose to research the possible impacts of this user-generated content for the early stages of the design process. This study begins by wanting to learn more about this content. Therefore, we ask, what type of information does user-generated content provide for design research? Secondly, to further narrow the scope of this research, we have decided to focus our attention on determining, is this information more pertinent to product design, service design, or product service system design? To answer these questions, we must first define the elements of the study. The next chapter will lay the foundations by exposing the key elements in design research, as well as distinguishing product design, and product service systems. And that is how the chapter 1 of Complexity of the Internet concludes. Next up, chapter 2. Thanks for listening. My name is Alexander Joyce, wishing you happy designing.